moving to pictures in an exhibition.
Yes.
A live album. How was the nature of this album different from the previous two?
Pictures was something that we had rehearsed and developed, really, for our own entertainment. And we never had envisaged recording it. But one day, we were at a show, and I think as part of a sort of improvisation, we started to play it. And it went down really well. And then we played it the next night, and it went down even better. And so, in the end, it became part of the live show. And so we decided just to record it like that. And it was recorded at Newcastle City Hall in England. And that was it. And I don't know even then whether we had ever envisaged it being an album. But what happened is it kept going down better and better in live concerts. So we were just due to play a tour of the United States. And we said to Atlantic Records at the time, look, we think we'd like to release this as our next album. And Arne Ertegun said, no, you can't do that. It'll never get played on the radio. And what happened was that a company called Island Records in England started to export the album out in vast quantities. And, of course, it started selling. God bless him, the late Scott Muni, WNEW.
Yes. Yeah.
Played it on the radio back to back, and of course that shot down any argument from Atlantic Records. And then the following week they released it, and it became a platinum selling album.
Scott was quite influential in radio here.
Oh yeah, very very yeah. very. I mean, you know, absolutely. Had he not played that album, I'm not sure Atlantic would have gone along with it. But he kind of broke that barrier.
We're speaking with Greg Lake here on the Morning Dew program at WBAI 99.5 FM here in New York City. Trilogy follows and is said to be one of your personal favorites.
I like Trilogy. I like all the albums for different reasons. But there's something special about Trilogy where I think the band had found its uniqueness, you know. The music had an identity like nobody else. It was really, it was unique. And I think there's a lot of beauty on Trilogy too. There's very beautiful music on it. And I think it's probably the peak of the band's innovative, creative power. And also, you know, Trilogy occurred at the same time that synthesizers went polyphonic. That is, instead of just playing one note, you could play bunches of them simultaneously. So, you know, now you could play five notes and, you know, make a complete chord out of sounds. And so the sounds were much richer, much more powerful. And of course, recording studios were developing at such a pace. I believe Trilogy was the first album that we made where they had 24-track recorders. So we had a lot more ability to overdub and do things like that. It was a much more creative record.
Be shaken away. in our way.
Emerson, Lake, and Palmer from the first live release, Pictures at an Exhibition. Our special guest, Greg Lake, with some nice guitar work on that cut called The Sage. I'm Stu Robbins. You're listening to the music and conversation of Greg Lake on Morning Dew here at 99.5 FM WBAI in New York. And then things got big again for radio airplay when the triple album After Brain Salad Surgery came out. And
yes.
Particularly due to the overwhelming success of Carnival 9 First Impression Part 2. Did you expect to get that much notoriety out of this project?
I think when we made, well, just to go back a little bit, when we made Trilogy, I mentioned to you that we did a lot of overdubbing because all of a sudden we had a lot more tracks available to us
right
in the recording studio. Problem was, when we came to play it live, there were a lot of things we couldn't perform because, you know, Keith only had two pairs of hands, one pair of hands, and that was it. And you know, so we realized that the next album we were going to make, we were going to make sure that we could perform it live. And so what we did is, I know this will now sound terribly extravagant, but it seemed quite sensible at the time. We bought a cinema and decided to create and rehearse and prepare the next album and record it in this cinema. It was in Fulham in London. We wrote the whole thing and rehearsed it live in the cinema. In the end, we did record it in a studio just to get the quality better. And that was it. So when we came to play it live, of course, you know, the whole thing could be performed properly. But that's where all the business of Welcome Back, My Friends, to the Show That Never Ends comes from. Because, of course, we were in this theatrical environment.
Ah, okay.
We were playing in a theater, and so it felt to us as though we were playing to an audience. And so that's how that whole scenario developed. And so it's all about live performance, that. And it was said that the setting really was about this sort of freaky circus. We've always, I think Pete and I have always been intrigued by circuses in one way or another. So it was a song about this freaky circus, and you were sort of welcoming the audience into this circus tent of surreality.
Welcome back, my friends, to the show that never ends. We're so glad you could attend. Come inside, come inside. There behind the glass stands a real blade of grass. Be careful as you pass. Move along, move along. Come inside, the show's about to start. Guaranteed to blow your head apart.
Die.
in a glaze of Vaseline. We'll perform our guillotine. What a scene, what a scene. Next up on the stand, will you please extend a hand to Alexander's ragtime band, Dixieland.
As for your writing, I had read that you agonized over composing some of your lyrics. Is this true?
Well, the song you're probably referring to is a thing called Closer to Believing, which I think we spent 2 months on, Pete and I, every single day. And, you know, it's just one of those things that we decided that every line in the song should contain an element of universal truth. That was the sort of benchmark we used. And that all the rhymes should be perfect. That they shouldn't be just near rhymes. You know, that every rhyme should be perfect. And that the whole thing, you know, we wanted it to have this sort of almost Shakespearean feel to it. And it really took some doing. And yeah, it took 2 months.
Wow.
But now I look back on it, I love it. You know, I mean, the middle eight for it says, from the opium of custom to the ledges of extremes, don't believe it till you've held it. Life is seldom what it seems. But lay your heart upon the table, and in the shuffling of dreams, remember who on earth you are. That couldn't have been written, I don't believe, in, you know, a quick off-the-cuff thing.
No, hardly.
You know, it took some real thought and some real, you know... And I would say it came from suffering, you know. We had to get, in a way, to a point where we were truly suffering.
Yeah.
Because then we were digging so deep, you know. We were digging deep, and when we found a line, we liked or we accepted, we'd almost have tears in our eyes. You know, we were so overjoyed at finding the right line. It got to, that was almost how intense it got. Now, we didn't do that with every song. You know, some songs were far, far quicker.
Yeah, I'm sure.
That one we did take a long time over.
I am closer to believing than I ever was before. On the crest of this elation, must I crash upon the shore? With the driftwood of acquaintance, light the fire to love once more. I am windblown. I am times. To be closer to believing, to be just a breath away. On the death of inspiration, I would buy back yesterday. But there's no crueler illusion, there's no sharper point to pay. As I reach out, it slips away. From the opium of custom to
to the ledges of extremes. Don't believe it till you've held it. Life is seldom what it seems. Lay your heart upon the table, and in the shuffling of dreams, remember who on earth you are.
Closer to Believing, the track Greg Lake stated that he and Peter Sinfeld were so meticulous in penning. We continue now with my conversation with Greg Lake.
Works Volume 1 was, I believe you said, was a fragmenting of the band at that point. What was going on with the group at that time?
You know, it was the beginning of the end, really, I think, in a way. It was where the band had done, I think, as much as we all... Now, looking back on it, I think it was really as much as we could have done with a three-piece electronic band. now I suppose, you know, you could go on and do other things. But at the time, we felt we'd blown every chord in our head, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
We'd done as much as we could. We tried everything. We'd been around, you know. And it also had something to do with we were never, because of the way the band was run at the time, and this is nobody's fault, it was just the way it was done in those days, there was never any time off, you know.
Yeah.
You weren't given 3 months off to reflect on things and, you know, collect your thoughts. Once you finished an album, the very next week you were out on tour.
Yeah. And
so there was no recuperation. There was no time to charge batteries. And I think at the end of it all, you know, we felt that, especially Keith felt, there was nowhere to go in the sort of three-piece band. And so his answer to that was to go orchestral. And so we fair enough, that's what, you know, we went down that road and we all got into that orchestral thing. And, you know, in some ways, I've got a lot of affection for the record. And as I said to you, songs like Closer to Believing are very special to me. But in terms of ELP, I think it was a strange album. And although it went platinum, and although the fans bought it, I think it was something that they bought and even liked, but they sensed that the band was going in its own, the band was splintering into individual careers at that point. And I think the public sensed that was the end of an era for ELP.
Well, if I'm correct here in the succession, things were getting a bit stressful around that time, for lack of a better word, and that was around the time of 1974's California Jam, when you played for 180,000 people.
California Jam, well, it's difficult to correlate all the dates, to be honest with you, but certainly during that orchestral period, it started to become, well, I didn't, after the orchestral stuff, I didn't produce any more records for ELP.
Okay.
That was the end of me producing records, and yes, I think if we could have done and we should have done, it would have been better if we'd have stopped after Works Volume One and then, you know, gone off and just done our own thing.
But you had a contractual obligation.
We had contractual obligations, and you know, the other thing was is when you've got something running like ELP, that becomes your identity. That becomes who you are. That is who the public have actually made you. You know, in a way, it sounds crazy to say it, but in a way, you're not yourself anymore.
Hmm.
You're ELP.
Yeah.
Mick Jagger is the Rolling Stones, you know.
True. It does change your identity, that's for sure.
Yeah, and if anybody doesn't think it's true, just try making a solo record. You soon find out that you know, the public perception of you know, and literally they make a band successful like ELP. It was the public that made that band successful, and it's quite right. So, yes, I just had the feeling that Works Volume 1 was the sort of moment when ELP really had passed its finest hour.
C'est la vie. Have your leaves all turned to brown? Will you scatter them around you? C'est la vie. Do you love? And then how am I to know if you don't let your love show for me? C'est la vie. Oh, c'est la vie. Oh, c'est la vie. Who knows, who cares for me? C'est la vie. In the night,
Do you light a lover's fire? Do the ashes of desire for you remain? Like the sea, there's a love too deep to show. Took a storm before my love flowed for you, c'est la vie. Oh, c'est la vie. Oh, c'est la vie. Who knows, who cares for me? C'est la vie.
Greg Lake, Keith Emerson, and Carl Palmer. ELP, channeling the music of Aaron Copland, and also from Works Volume 1, Greg's beautiful melodic vocals on the piece known as C'est la vie. As we continue with my conversation with Greg, I asked him if he could tell us a little bit about his experience in the Middle East filming the video for I Believe in Father Christmas.
Yeah, I can. It was, some bright spark came up with that. We wanted to make a video. It was the beginning of rock and roll videos. And this was 1974, I think, when this was made. Somebody came up with the idea, because there was obviously Christmas has a religious connection. Somebody said, oh, why don't we go and film it in Israel? Because there's some beautiful scenery, some of the biblical scenes there. So, okay, let's do that. So we all went down to Israel, and that was a real culture shock for me, just getting off the plane and looking down the end of a machine gun, being held by an 18-year-old college student, fairly unnerving sort of feeling,
It's culture shock for you there.
And at that time, I'm sure it's a lot different today, but at that time, everybody who entered into Israel was a terrorist, as far as they were concerned. Yeah. Yeah. So you were treated badly as you arrived. But after that, it was very pleasant, and we got into the country and went to some beautiful. I did some of the filming actually in the actual caves where the Dead Sea Scrolls were discovered. Way up in this cliff, there was a cave. And they discovered the Dead Sea Scrolls in there. We managed to find a way into that cave. And that's why I did some of the filming there. Some of the filming in the desert near Eilat with the Bedouins. That was remarkable.
Wow, I bet was.
The Bedouins were due to arrive at 11 o'clock in the morning in the middle of this desert. And we got there. We must have got there about an hour before with our little trailers, our Winnebagos and all of that, and we set it all up, and you could see in every direction, up to the horizon.
Wow.
In every direction, you could see all the way to the horizon, and we had chosen this little picturesque oasis. It had a few palm trees and a little bit of water there, and it was truly an oasis in the desert. And anyway, we got there about an hour earlier, and we were just waiting around and waiting and waiting. It got to 11 o'clock, and I'm looking in every direction in the desert, and I can't see a soul. And we're waiting for these Bedouins. And we had some army people with us who'd arranged all this. And I said, well, where are the Bedouins? They're not here. He said, trust me, they'll be here. And I said, but forgive me, but if you look out there, to the horizon, there are no Bedouins in any direction. There's no one. He said, listen, what you don't understand is the Bedouins never walk over the dunes. They walk in the gaps between them. They never walk over the top of the dune. They always walk in the low points.
Yeah.
So you never see them. And sure enough, 5 minutes after that, slowly but slowly out of the desert, starts coming. First came the women with a few camels, and then there was hundreds and hundreds of Bedouins came, and they set their tents and everything, and we made the film.
Wow. It was quite a memory.
Thing. Yeah, it really was a memory. And when you look on, if you do see the clip of that film, you can see it there. It truly is an incredible setting. And they're incredible people, the Bedouins. They told me a story. I mean, I don't want to take up your time.
No, that's okay.
They told me this story about when the Israelis were fighting with the whoever else they fight down there. They were shelling across a valley at each other, firing guns at each other across this valley. And the Bedouins, when the Bedouins walked through the valley, they stopped firing both sides to allow them to go through.
Really?
Yeah. They allow them to pass, and then they start the war up again.
Which all seems so senseless to begin with, but yeah.
Yeah, yeah. just unbelievable.
That's interesting.
They said there'll be snow at Christmas. They said there'll be peace on earth. But instead it just kept on raining. A veil of tears for the virgin birth. I remember one Christmas morning, a winter's light and a distant choir. The peal of a bell and that Christmas tree smell. The eyes full of tinsel and fire. Dream of Christmas. They sold me a silent night. They told me a fairy story till I believed in the Israelite. And I believed in Father Christmas. I looked to the sky with excited eyes. Then I woke with a yawn in the first light of dawn. I saw him and through his disguise.
Greg Lake, our special guest, with a seasonal favorite, I Believe in Father Christmas, right here on Morning Dew, 99.5 FM, WBAI in New York. Our program rapidly coming to a conclusion, so I'm going to read a quote from Greg. He said, "I was in a successful rock and roll band. Ringo Starr was in a band that changed the world. That's the difference." So in closing, I asked him about some of the great acts he's had the good fortune of sharing the stage with.
You know, Ringo was an absolute joy to play with. I mean, he's a lovely man, and he's a great drummer, too.
I always thought so. A lot of people never gave him the credit.
I know. Well, the thing is, he's not demonstrative, Ringo. He's not one of those drum solo, you know, see how fast I can play, guys. He's all about feel.
Uh-huh.
Ringo is all about feel, and there's no one like him. When you have to play with him, he's got just this. He's just on the back end of the beat. Lovely offbeat feel, and you can feel what the beat. Well, that's what one of the things the Beatles had was this beautiful sense of time. You know.
Yeah.
And he that was him. You know, he is also a perfectionist, which is another thing that, you know, people always used to see Ringo as this sort of floppy guy, happy-go-lucky guy at the back. In reality, he's a bit of a taskmaster, you know. He wants things right, yeah.
Uh-huh.
Not only his material, but when you're playing your songs, you know, if I did Lucky Man or if I did Welcome Back, My Friend, you know, had to be right, had to be right.
Huh.
He's very determined to get things right. And, of course, that's another identifier of the Beatles. Their stuff was always as near perfect as you can get it.
Yeah.
That's... You won't find many mistakes on Beatles records, let me tell you.
That's for sure.
So Ringo, yeah, fantastic, lovely man,
humble man,
decent man, and I also enjoy. I was on the Who's last single.
Oh, really?
It was interesting working with Robert and Pete, Roger, and I do some work sometimes with Robert Plant. We do this Teenage Cancer Trust thing together.
I see.
I get around a bit, but not enough. I really enjoy playing with other people. I wish I could do it more. When you're in a band like ELP, you end up playing the same 18 songs all your life. You know?
Yeah.
I mean...
You're branded.
You you don't play enough music, really.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm very good at playing pictures and exhibition, but, you know, you tend not to play enough varied music, and so it's always good to get out and about and play with people.
Yeah.
I always enjoy it, and as I say, I wish we could do more of it. The Trans-Siberian Orchestra is fantastic. I mean, they're lovely guys, and it's always fun working with them. Of course, that's a Christmas thing.
Yes, yeah. Now, speaking of other artists, if I were to take your iPod from you, if you had one, assume, what would I find on your playlist from other people?
About 1,300 songs, I think, from last time I looked.
Okay. I'm not going to ask you to name them all.
No. But you would find a lot of things. I mean, when we started this conversation, I said to you, I really have got so many things I like. From very new modern things to, you know, old things, classical music, country music, 1950s rock and roll. Joni Mitchell, all kinds of, you know. So there's just too much to just say. Well,
yeah.
And I feel bad, you know, when I mention somebody who I might like out of. I feel bad because I think, well, what about all the other people, you know?
Yeah.
So there are just so many. But you know what? They're probably not so dissimilar from all the people you like.
That's true.
We all like the same, basically. You know what? That's what makes music popular.
Exactly.
That's what makes it popular. We all like the Beatles. I mean,
right.
If you don't, you know, well, I can't help you, but I mean... you know, we all like the same things. We all like the Stones for certain things. And, yeah, so everybody's got certain things they like and respect. And I don't think it matters what genre of music it is. It's really, is it good or not? You know,
yeah.
Does it come from the heart? Is it meant?
Yeah, yeah. Well, my wife, I hate to say this, but she... admitted to not being a very big Beatles fan, although she respects them. But I married her anyway. What can I tell you?
Yeah, well,
she's a good girl.
Yeah. Well, that's all right. You know, look, that's the beautiful thing about music is I too have met people who don't like the Beatles. It's hard to understand, but I do, and but that's it. You know, that's the wonderful thing.
Yeah.
There's so much great music that there's a place for everybody. Everybody can have their own thing. They got their own little world. Everybody can have their own little musical world that they like.
That's true. That's true. Okay, we're speaking with Greg Lake today here on Morning Dew at 99.5 FM WBAI in New York. Greg, thank you so much for taking out this time to put this program together. I just want to say thanks, and it's been
a real pleasure. Very nice to talk to you.
Thank you, and have a happy and healthy new year.
Thank you, you too.
You wanna be an angel, you wanna be a star. You wanna play some magic on my guitar. You wanna be a poet, you wanna be my string. You could be anything. Do you wanna be the lover of another? Undercover, you could even be the man on the moon.
a string. Let me tell you something, it just don't mean a thing. You see, it really doesn't matter when you're buried in disguise by the dark gloss on your eyes. Though your flesh has crystallized, still can recall. It doesn't matter at all.